Hi, I'm Luke Dennis, the Development Director at WYSO. We are happy we can deliver these programs to you, people who listen on the web, and we rely on you to help us pay for this service. So at our website, wyso.org, click Support This Station and help keep these services coming. And thank you.
Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. It's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Archer Mayer. His new book is Three Can Keep a Secret. He joins us by telephone from, I'm guessing, Vermont.
You're correct, Vic.
How are you doing, Archer?
Well, I'm doing very well. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat about this book and anything else that crosses your brain.
This series features a guy named Joe Gunther. I understand you've written a couple of these.
Yeah, you could say that. This is actually entry number 24.
Wow.
And just to prove I'm on a roll, I've just finished number 25, which is due out next fall, and I'm editing it right now. Or I would be if I weren't on the phone.
Well, you gotta still do publicity for 24. You can't just keep moving into 25 like that, Archer.
Well, I know. I should slap myself, but I'm not that clever. Actually, it's funny. I have been doing this for a long time. I crank out about one of these a year, they all take place in Vermont, and they all feature the same squad of police officers. I try to make them sort of parallel real life to a certain extent. I mean, the cases are make-believe, but I do place all these books in real-time Vermont, and I pay attention to crossing my T's and dotting my I's in terms of getting everything accurate. So I have a lot of proofreaders in law enforcement. Actually, I'm a cop myself, so I look over my own shoulder on a lot of the protocols and procedures.
Doesn't that kind of give you a advantage in the crime fiction genre to actually be a police officer?
Actually, you know, the biggest advantage that it gives me as a cop is that I write a really good search warrant application.
Aren't you also involved with forensics?
I am. I'm a death investigator for the Medical Examiner's Office, which is a state agency, and I've been doing that for quite a while. Also, funnily enough, though, it's a bit of a turnaround. Most people think that that I've done all this and that I have these full-time jobs, and that I all of a sudden woke up one morning and said, wow, these are good stories. Maybe I'll become a writer as well. But in fact, it was the exact opposite of that. I began to write these books. The first one came out in 1988, Open Season by name. The wonderful part was that since I applied myself to reflecting the real world and therefore used real cops as resources and real lawyers and real forensic scientists and medical examiners and all the rest, these guys only took a couple of years to sort of scratch their head and says, wow, he's actually writing down on these fictional books what we're telling him. So they came knocking on my door and said, hey, you want to do a little bit more than just write about it? Why don't you join up? So first the medical examiner gave me a job, and then the police did.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you kind of went at it backwards.
Yeah, backwards. Well, only in Vermont, you know. You say, yes, I'm a professional liar, and they went, oh, well, we want you on board.
Oh, I thought that was for politics.
Yeah, I know. Go figure. You know, well, we do quirky things here in this state.
Okay. The new book is Three Can Keep a Secret. It's a Joe Gunther novel. Archer Mayer wrote it. He joins us on the program today. For those of our listeners who have not read the previous 23 books, can you tell us, first of all, who the heck is Joe Gunther? And then a little bit about the trajectory of this series, where it's taken him.
Sure. In many ways, it hasn't taken him anywhere because I picked him up in middle age, and he remains middle-aged. I sort of like the idea that he's a reflection of a state of mind rather than an actual chronological journey. But what he and his team amount to are narrators of the human condition. I don't want to sound hopelessly snotty, but what I like to really write about aren't so much unraveling puzzles. I'm not a sort of Agatha Christie type writer, and I'm not a huge reader of those kinds of books. What I'm mostly interested in is things like conflict resolution, crisis management on the parts of regular human beings, sociological, anthropological things like that. But to say it that way makes it sound hopelessly stuffy. So instead, I inject a good guy, bad guy, dead guy in a car chase, and I've got, in the context of a real world, the real world being that every day when you pick up the newspaper, you see, you know, murder and mayhem, I mirror that world, but I also put in the kind of things that interest me, such as not who done it, but why. And it's really that analysis of the culture that I find most interesting. And that, of course, brings us right back to my talking and writing about Vermont, because I've taken the entire state and sort of turned it into an anthropological petri dish. So I travel all over the state, and I have these books take place all over the state, and I try to sort of analyze why it is we do what we do in times of crisis.
I was struck by the fact that as the book opens, they're dealing with the aftermath of a hurricane. Is it common for hurricanes to impact a state like Vermont?
Well, it's happened on periodic occasion. We call them 100-year storms, but of course, as with all such titles, there's no real truth to it analytically. It's just that they are rare enough that they occur every few decades, but when they do occur, they kill people, and they kill people in quite copious numbers. This year, we got off with a mere 6 deaths, which is only a good statistic when compared to the 1920s and 1930s, when Vermont's population dipped dramatically as a result of flooding and whatnot. It's just a strange kind of, you may recall, or maybe you don't, but for a long, long, long time, many decades, nearby Mount Washington in neighboring New Hampshire clocked and held the record for the highest temperatures ever recorded on the face of the earth. So climatically, despite our placid appearance, we can really work up a storm here. And Hurricane Irene, which turned into Tropical Storm Irene in Vermont's case, was a perfect exemplar of that. It just rained and rained and rained. Funnily enough, there were no winds whatsoever, but it rained like crazy. And Vermont has a kind of a dinosaur-aged spinal column that runs right down its middle in the form of the Green Mountains. And the water just runs off both sides and goes down all these ravines and waterways and wipes out all the roads and takes out the bridges and dams. It was a mess. It was a total mess.
Did I hear that right? Mount Washington in New Hampshire had the highest temperature, hotter than places like Death Valley?
No, high winds, not temperature, high winds.
I thought you said temperature, and I'm looking at my producer to see if he heard that too. He's nodding his head.
I'm a hopelessly old man just rattling on. You know what can I tell you?
No, when you said that, I thought, I hear that? Okay, the highest winds. Now I believe it.
I told you, Vic, that I'm a professional liar. I'm good at it, ain't I?
Well, I actually try to listen during these interviews.
Dan, what are you thinking?
Well, three can keep a secret, or at least I can.
Wind speed, about 230-something miles an hour. I can't remember the details, but for decades, the top of Mount Washington clocked and held that record. So heat has nothing to do with it. I was just wandering amiss on that one.
Now, does the Appalachian Trail go by there?
It does.
Okay, yeah. All right. I remember something in Bill Bryson's book about going past there.
Yeah. Don't do it in the middle of winter.
And I can imagine. Okay, so I don't want to give away any spoilers, but set the scene in this one. We got some kind of strange things going on.
We certainly do, and it's reflective of my brain, as you've begun to discover. It starts with the storm. As a cop and as a medical examiner, both my talents were called upon. There was a young man who went missing during the storm, and we've never found him to this day, but the storm we sense played some sort of role, but we don't know what. So I was wandering around in the middle of all this and really got up close and personal with the actual storm and the after effects. The next, very next day was a beautiful sunny day, by the way. And the medical examiner capacity was called upon because a cemetery was wiped away and a third of its contents to wash downstream. So obviously you can see where a lot of death investigators were called in there to see what they could find and recapture, if you will, and reinter. So it was pretty wild times, and it allowed me full scope and accessibility to, or access to the devastation. Well, this was 2 years ago, and I also was able to interview a lot of people who were knee-deep in the same kind of activities I was at the time. And one thing led to another, and I began to stitch some of these adventures together and then change them for the sake of fiction, because I never want to actually mention real cases or embarrass real people. So we began to weave a fabric of the effects of the storm in physical state, the effects of that storm on something like the state mental hospital, which was severely flooded, and I therefore superimpose one of the patients getting away and vanishing into the woodwork for a while. Then I have another part that touches on an old folks home, where somebody murders one of the old residents. What would that make them be 50 or so years ago? Well, major movers and shakers within the fabric of Vermont. So I go back 50 years to analyze what was going on in Vermont. Furthermore, I do a little erosion myself with another cemetery I just made up out of whole cloth. And instead of a body found in a grave, there's a pile of rocks that's 17 years old. So where's the real body? You can see, just by my rattling off certain parts of this book, how I like to take occasionally apparently disparate elements and sew them together into a patchwork quilt with, I hope, a highly organized level of success for my readers at the tail end. It's fun for me. I write without a plot or an outline. I write pretty much the way my readers read, one page at a time. I edit like crazy after it's done so that the seamlessness is imposed, and my readers tell me that I'm pretty successful at that in terms of just telling them a story that just moves right along and entertains them and goes to the four corners of the state in the process. So it's kind of a bit of a roller coaster ride, but you never try to make a mistake and you never try to show off, so everyone has a good ride.
Well, I love reading crime fiction, and I've got a lot of favorites, a lot of favorite writers, a lot of favorite books, and I really like the way in your book you have these disparate threads, and the one in particular where they find the box of rocks, the coffin filled with rocks that's been exposed by the flooding. It seemed to me that you were really trying to use this particular situation as a way for us to get to know this investigator who is on the case. He's a really interesting guy.
Yeah, he's a regular. His name is Willie Kunkel. He's a combat veteran, a man with PTSD, anger issues. He's a recovering alcoholic. He's a rough piece of work, but he has integrity the as long as the day is available, and his boss, Joe Gunther, the one we mentioned earlier, rides him carefully and allows him his creative juices, but by the same token, keeps him employed, because this guy in many ways would be fired under normal circumstances. What I wanted to avoid was a cartoon, edgy character that we see so often on TV who, frankly, wouldn't be employed. He'd probably be thrown in prison the way these guys carry around on TV and in movies. But Willie Kunkel never goes that far, or if he does, then he's off the job, and we don't really know much about that. And it's a counterbalance to Joe Gunther, who is a thoughtful, avuncular, very thoughtful fellow, who is kind of a father figure to a good many other members of the squad, of which there are about four or five. So I appreciate your comment there, because it occurred to me, as it happened to me in the midst of this very chaotic physical time for the state of Vermont, we had to do, all of us had to do multiple things at once. And so it occurred to me that it would be good to have Willie Kunkel have a case that, in fact, does not connect to the other major case of the book. And it would serve to keep him busy. It would serve to tell the reader just how, overworked we all were at the time. But it would also be a window into Willie's character. And last but not least, it allowed also, I played a little bit with the symbolism of water. We've only talked about the destructiveness of this storm, but in fact, water can also be a cleansing factor. And in this case, I think the revealing of that grave was in fact more curative than destructive by the time you reach the end of the book. And that was important for a troubled soul like Willie Kunkel to escort.
And Willie really relates to these other troubled souls. This coffin filled with stones exposes a really messed up family. And it's not the only messed up family in this story. There's a lot of real dysfunction here. This fella who turns up dead at the retirement community, he's a former political mover and shaker. And when we learn about him and hear about his personality, it's easy to think, well, there could have been hundreds of people who wanted to kill him.
Yeah. No lie. You know, and the sad part is, Vic, I got the things that I've done in both the other jobs that we quoted expose me inordinately, perhaps, to dysfunctionality. As a cop, I'm now somewhat inactive because I'm not getting any younger. But my last two jobs were investigative in nature. The first one, I ran a sex crimes against kids special investigations unit. I did that for about 3 years. And then for the state's attorney's office, who is the head prosecutor in my county, I was doing major crimes, rapes and murders and whatnot, and chasing down those. So one could say that the slices of life that I get exposed to in those capacities are hardly upbeat and comical. But they are truly human. I'm not a pessimist by nature. I'm fairly upbeat about my species, but I'm also not going to blink at their shortcomings. So I talk about them, not over much. I'm not a manic depressive writer, but I do not want to turn my back on a lot of dysfunctionality that occurs all around us. So when people talk about Vermont, they think, oh, yeah, skiers and fat, happy cows and maple syrup and beautiful leaves. I mention all those things. I'm happy to herald them. But I also want to point out that Vermont is a pretty depressed economic state and a lot of very unhappy people living in the backwoods and not making ends meet and visiting that unhappiness upon one another. You just got to be even-handed and open about these things.
When I think of Vermont, I think of cheese.
As do a lot of visitors.
Yeah, I love the cheese.
Yeah.
You have this complicated story here, and I don't want to give away any spoilers, but I think a central element in it is political corruption and this governor for a day. Did they ever really do something like that?
No, I made that one up out of whole cloth. But it is the kind of thing that politicians will do. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, I would look at everyone with gray hair and I'd say, wow, they must know what they're doing because they're running all the companies and the president of the United States has gray hair and I'm just a little snot nose. And I was a kid in the 50s. I was born in 1950. And I looked to them with a certain amount of awe and respect, and I felt comfortable because clearly they knew what they were doing. Like I said, the 50s. Well, now I'm older than the President of the United States by quite a stretch, and I guess I've come to the realization that, wow, all these guys know as much or less about how to do stuff than I do. That's a real cold water moment. And you realize that, a bunch of legislators you're standing around and saying, "Oh, I know how to make people like us more. We'll make a governor for a day. You know, we'll just grab someone off the street and anoint her or him with this special honor and drive them around in a limousine car. And at the end of the day, give them a dinner, and that's the end of that." You could see these crazy guys doing something like that, especially back when. And that's exactly what I have occur in this book. But of course, it turns out considerably differently than one might have imagined.
Our guest is Archer Mayer. His new Joe Gunther novel, Three Can Keep a Secret, his 24th novel in the series. And as soon as he gets off of the phone with us, he's going to start editing his 25th, which is all written, huh?
All written, yeah. Wow. Well, my wife has taken on a lot of the business aspects of the Archer Mayer Incorporated company, if you will. Go to archermayer.com, and you'll find out, you know, all the various things that we're doing. And as a result, it's allowed me to get back to writing and editing, which is what one would like to think the writing life is all about. That, in fact, if you don't operate as a business person, and also as a writer, or understand that that's part of being a writer, then you're going to come up short. It's a very complicated world nowadays. All this internet and e-books type environment is a very shoal-filled shore, and you need to really keep on your toes. It's exciting, and it's filled with opportunity. But you sure work 7 days a week, let me tell you.
What are some of these other endeavors you're alluding to?
Well, I have the good fortune, just by dumb luck, that at some point in my career, as I was cranking out a book a year, I looked over my shoulder and realized that the publisher that was sharpening its pencil and put all of a sudden, in one fell swoop, about 14 to 18 of my titles from number one on up out of print. Well, this is something you sort of learn to expect as a writer, and you sort of shrug your shoulders, but that's because most writers have outside jobs. Well, I don't. And so I said to them, well, if you're not going to publish them, and therefore they're just going to disappear from the face of the earth, can I have them back? Because I don't have your kind of overhead. I could possibly publish them, which would support your efforts in turning out the hardbacks, the new ones, and I'll take care of the backlist, and then we'll be complimentary to each other. Well, just parenthetically, I had also been reading the trades and discovering about e-books, that they were up and coming. Well, publishers at that time were seeing e-books as competition. They also didn't think they'd last, that they would disappear and just be a little tiny niche market. I disagreed. So as soon as I got these books, we not only publish them as trade paperbacks, which you can get through the source I just listed on the internet, but we turned them into ebooks. And that was a way of enhancing the readers being able to get hold of the backlist. Because I don't know about you, but I go to a book store and I see this $25 to $30 hardback, and I go, well, what do you got in paper? So that I can whet my appetite and see if I want to go to the big leagues and buy a hardback. And if there's no paperback, well, then I might be inclined to walk away. So it's important to me to have this backlist. And also, these stories touch on these characters that you and I have been discussing. They run through the whole series. And I didn't want to truncate my life's work simply because the major New York publisher couldn't swing, because of overhead problems. Well, I can help out, and that's exactly what's come about. I have now a symbiotic relationship with my New York publishers. It works rather well, so we help each other out. I'll do publicity for them. They do publicity for me, me being the backlist that they don't even own. And it's worked out pretty nicely, and it's emblematic of the nimbleness that publishing has had to embrace very recently.
Well, that was prescient of you to see that when you did. Archer Mayer joins us. His new novel, Three Can Keep a Secret. It's a Joe Gunther novel. And I'm assuming, not being familiar with Vermont politics, that what you describe in your story of it being very conservative and then shifting, like in the 60s or 70s,
yes.
Is that accurate?
It is accurate. Yeah, Vic, all this stuff, I do have some fun with the plots and whatnot, but I always try to be highly accurate in all that kind of stuff that I describe in these books. People have come to rely on my accuracy in these portraits of Vermont. And it is true that prior to the 60s, Vermont was a rock-ribbed Republican enclave and had been for generations. I mean, it's absolutely trustworthy for the right wingers, or the conservatives, I should say, more less loadedly. Mm-hmm. And in 1.5 decades, it changed. I mean, people jokingly refer to this state as the Socialist Republic of Vermont. Yeah, I mean, if you're not a Democrat, you're a very lonely critter. I'm an independent myself, but when we vote for a governor, we can choose from among about 8 different people. We have, progressives and anti this and pro that and everything else. But the Republicans are a very moderate bunch and grossly outnumbered by any number of other parties, but dominantly the Democrats. The Democrats really own the state. It's thinly populated. I mean, there are a variety of reasons that Vermont went that way, but it was so interesting to me, being interested in politics and history. That was my degree in college, was U.S. history, to see a state like Vermont go through such an extraordinary weather change in a very short period of time. And I wanted to look into a little bit of that and share it with my readers in this book.
Archer, I know you're pretty methodical and consistent. You put out about a book a year, and this one that you're editing right now that'll come out this time next year. Can you give us just a hint about what that one's about?
Sure. It's called Proof Positive. It's a play on words with, I used to be a photographer back in an earlier era, and so a positive proof was a way of analyzing what was on your negative back in the old days of photography. And that plays a crucial part in this overall plot. But as with Three Can Keep a Secret, being stimulated by a major storm, this book is stimulated by the advent of hoarding. As a cop and as a medical examiner, I've been involved in hoarding environments quite a bit. And I find them fascinating, and I find hoarders quite interesting and fascinating folks to talk with and to discuss this subject with. And so I begin the book in a hoarding environment where, unfortunately, in this case, the hoarder is deceased. But the question then becomes, why and how was he made so? And what may be or may not be in the heart of the hoard? And so we do a sort of a biographical search in this guy's history, and we touch on the Vietnam War, and once again we go into politics a little, only this time it's national politics. So I go down to Philadelphia in part, where I did a lot of research. It was an interesting book to put together. I had great fun. I always have fun turning these books out, I have to admit.
Well, what a wonderful teaser. I'll be looking forward to that one, and we really appreciate your time today.
It was my pleasure entirely, Vic. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Book Nook, and our guest today has been Archer Mayer. His new Joe Gunther novel, 3 Can Keep a Secret. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. Thanks for listening. Next week on the program, a first-time novelist, James Rang, is a retired FBI agent, and he knows a lot about terrorism and the FBI. His first novel, Necessary Assets, will terrify you in the Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.